Hello and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. Special shout out and hello to Leah Copperman. She subscribed to the show on iTunes right in front of me yesterday at NTC, the Nonprofit Technology Conference. Welcome Leah Copperman, our newest listener. And she's at Copperwoman on Twitter if you want to follow her. That's Copperwoman with a K. I'm glad you're with me. I'd be hit with acute glomerulonephritis if I had to again drink in the idea that you missed today's show. Eight areas of nonprofit excellence. The Nonprofit Coordinating Committee Excellence Awards are based on tough criteria that reveal the right way to run your organization in areas like fundraising, management, board, financial, and diversity. Michael Clark and Melkis Alvarez-Baez are from the Nonprofit Coordinating Committee, and they're with me to explain the standards. On Tony's Take Two, I got great interviews at the Nonprofit Technology Conference this week. We're sponsored by Generosity Series. They host multi-charity 5K runs and walks. I'm very glad to welcome, it's a pleasure to welcome Michael Clark and Melkis Alvarez-Baez to the show. Michael is president of the Nonprofit Coordinating Committee of New York. He has 35 years of training and experience in urban issues, public health, and nonprofit management. And they are at NPCCNY on Twitter. Melkis Alvarez-Baez, Director of Programs at Nonprofit Coordinating Committee of New York. One of the programs she directs is the New York Community Trust Nonprofit Excellence Awards that we're talking about today. And she's at Melkis Alvarez on Twitter. Michael, Melkis, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Pleasure.
It's a pleasure to
be able to spend the hour talking about some, I think, extraordinary guidelines, eight specific areas that nonprofits could very much benefit from. Michael, our president, NPCC New York, where do these eight areas of excellence come from that the awards are based on?
Well, it's funny you should ask, Tony. We actually
did you prepare an answer for that?
I did prepare an answer, and not only prepared, but it's the truth. 10 years ago, we looked around the country and we realized there are 36 state and regional associations of nonprofits like ours, representing a total of about 25,000 nonprofit organizations, and 19 of them have developed their own standards for what are the key areas of management that you have to do really well so that your organization performs at a high level and as a CEO so you don't get fired. So the point is, we took a look at those. We identified, even though they don't all quite agree with each other, identified eight areas that they all had in common.
Okay.
And we decided to use those eight areas to build a slightly different kind of program. Most of those are certification programs. You take a workshop, you pass a test, they say, okay, you're certified in financial management, you're certified in this. We thought we would create an aspirational program, one that really talks about what do the excellent practices in financial management look like? What do the excellent practices in communication look like? Because I think these days most people are trying to figure out how to make their organizations perform better. So these are guides to how to make your organization perform better in those eight areas.
And quite well detailed. And we're going to have time, since we have the full hour, to get into some of the detail of it. Now, only 19 of the 38 organizations had standards of some type. I mean, that's only half.
Yeah, well, that's all within the last 5 or 10 years. I mean, it's a trend that they're gradually developing these programs
more and more.
Yeah.
Melkis is nodding.
I think last time I checked, it was actually 21 of them that had some sort of standards program.
All right. It's growing. Mm-hmm. I just came from our national conference, and we talked a lot there about standards of excellence programs and also about the Excellence Awards program. And we're one of only two organizations that has an Excellence Awards strategy.
Oh, cool. All right.
The other one is Washington, D.C.
All right. Now, Melkis, this is a lot more than an awards ceremony, right? I mean, let's talk about the workshops that are involved all year. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're raising really the level of lots and lots of nonprofits, whether they're in the awards competition or not.
Yeah, we actually like to say that the awards is an educational program disguised as an awards program. And it's a quite lengthy process from March to November, culminating in that final awards ceremony where we sort of announce three winners. But really, the entire process, even the application, is meant to be educational for applicants so that there's something for all of the organizations that go through the process, even those that don't win. Right. And the idea is that by going through this application process, they're learning about their management practices and how to improve them. at the end of each awards program, we also put on a series of workshops that are actually going on now. They're called the Pathways to Excellence workshops. And the idea with those is to really disseminate the best management practices in each of these eight key areas that we're going to talk about from past winners of the awards.
And it was that awards ceremony last November that motivated me to have the two of you on the show because I was so taken by how the organizations had risen to the challenge of the eight areas. There were three organizations on stage, but I know there's lots and lots of organizations. As I said, I mean, even beyond the ones that are in the competition, yep. There's lots of organizations learning a lot about very, very good practices. And it was just I hadn't heard of the awards. Sorry to say, I hadn't heard of them before I was invited.
Working on that.
Okay, all right. Well, I am too. I'm helping you. We're getting it out to 10,000 more people. Yeah, I was invited to go by a friend. He and I went, and I really was taken by the descriptions of the organizations out there, the three that were on the stage, the finalists, and just the overall explanation of the eight areas. So, welcome. I'm glad I was there. I'm glad you're here.
The practices. The good thing about the program when you come to those awards, and when you sit through the best practices workshop, is you're listening to people that have actually had to implement these things.
Yes.
So this is not somebody's theory about how to do this stuff. This is just lessons straight from the field.
Right. How they've
done. And I think I think nonprofit managers recognize that right away. It has an authenticity that you wouldn't necessarily see if you read a lot of books. There are something over 7 million entries in Google for nonprofit excellence. So
okay.
It's a confusing world. But
let's start to get into our eight. Because there are eight. And I want, just as an overview, I'm going to tick them off, okay, if you'll allow me.
Great.
So people know what's coming up. The first we're going to talk about is effective and ethical fundraising and resource development, overall management focus on results, governance structure that moves the organization forward, strong, transparent, and accountable financial management, diversity and culturally competent organizational practices, enlightened use of human resources. That's interesting. Enlightened use. Appropriate and reliable information technology, IT systems, and regular and effective communications and use of communications technology. That's where we're headed. Let's start with the fundraising and effective and ethical fundraising and resource development. Let's start with you, Michael. One of the things, now there's lots of bullets under all of them, and we obviously do not have time for all that, for each bullet. That's impossible. But let's look at a couple. Like, fundraising revenue streams are as diverse as possible. What are we looking for there? Why is it important?
You're looking for something that looks like a pyramid. And a lot of nonprofits' finances look like an inverted pyramid. In other words, you're looking for some money coming from private donors, some money coming from foundations, some money coming from government, some money coming from corporations. And that, there's a very simple reason for that. If you have only one source of revenue, then you're extremely vulnerable to changes in politics or changes in foundation trends or changes in whatever that one source is.
Yeah.
So better to have your...
That's very risky.
Yes. So, just to keep... To be as sustainable as possible. That's a big word in the nonprofit sector, sustainability. Yeah. To be as sustainable as possible, you want to have as diverse range of sources of money as you can get.
The board... So I'll tell you what. Maybe we'll go back and forth. So, Michael will cover... Michael will cover we'll talk about the fundraising, and then Melkus will do the next area. Okay, will that be all right?
Mm-hmm.
But then chime in too. Let's have a conversation.
Sure.
I don't mean to shut you off, Melkus. If you want to add something about effective ethical fundraising, please do. Okay. The board, overall responsibility for raising funds to meet the organization's needs. The responsibility for fundraising resides with the board, Michael.
It actually does. There are three basic principles built into nonprofit law about what board members are supposed to do, and one of them is called the duty of care, and that involves making sure the organization is sustainable and has revenue. A lot of board members walk onto boards and never realize that. We do a lot of training with board members and coaching, and they say, "Really, I'm supposed to help them raise money?" Absolutely. It's part of the job of being a board member. So, board members frequently represent very different kinds of backgrounds than the managers, but they bring a lot to the table.
Okay, and we're looking for 100% annual giving on the board.
A good standard is to have 100% of your board giving something personally. Some boards set a number. Some just say give something that's meaningful to you. But somehow you want 100% giving. Yep.
The idea with that is that if your board members aren't giving, then it's hard to convince others to give to your organization.
For sure. They're your key. They're your key volunteers.
Right.
They're your prime stakeholders. If they're not doing it, why should others?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cool. I'll tell you what. Let's go out on a break. And when we come back, we're gonna we'll get to our next area, which is gonna be overall management focus on results. And then we got six other areas after that. So hang there with us.
You're tuned to Nonprofit Radio. Tony Martinetti also hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a quick 10-minute burst of fundraising insights published once a month. Tony's guests are expert in crowdfunding, mobile giving, event fundraising, direct mail, and donor cultivation. Really, all the fundraising issues that make you wonder, am I doing this right? Is there a better way? There is. Find the Fundraising Fundamentals archive at TonyMartinetti.com. That's MartinetiNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. Thousands of listeners have subscribed on iTunes. You can also learn more at the Chronicle website, philanthropy.com. Fundraising Fundamentals, the better way.
Welcome back to Big Nonprofit Ideas for the Other 95%. Let's do live listener love. Let's do it early because we got a lot. Menominee, Wisconsin. Love it. Menominee. I love that. St. Louis, Missouri. Woodbury, New Jersey. New Bern, North Carolina. I'm going to be there in a couple weeks in North Carolina anyway. New York, New York. Live listener love to each of you. We'll go abroad a little later on. Got to send out the podcast pleasantries to people listening in the time shift on any device, anytime. Podcast pleasantries to you and our affiliate affections. We love our affiliates throughout the country. Lots of affection going out to them. Melkus,
yep.
Let's look at this overall management focus on results and why a well-defined mission statement is important.
Yeah, I mean, I think mission statements can tend to be kind of cloudy sometimes. They're up there, right? And this area really has to do with organizations defining the difference that they want to make in people's lives and the communities that they're serving, and then setting sort of milestones and benchmarks to assess and track their own progress towards that difference, right? Towards the impact that they ultimately want to see.
And there's a point made that it's a well-defined mission statement.
Mm-hmm.
So narrowly focused, right. What else should be well-defined?
Geographical focus also. In terms of when it comes to what the selection committee is looking for, a strong response in this question, they're looking to get a sense from the mission statement what an organization does, right? And ultimately, if an organization has to take a paragraph to explain what they do, then perhaps it's worth revisiting the mission statement.
Okay. You mentioned the selection committee. Who is the selection committee for the awards?
Yeah, the selection committee is a group of about 32 consultants, nonprofit leaders.
Holy cow, that's a big committee.
Yeah.
You have a committee of 32?
Yep, and the idea is that we have about four people strong in each of these eight areas.
Okay. Oh, I see. Oh, all right. So there's target. Oh, so there's teams.
Yep.
Subcommittees. Oh, excellent. Okay. Expert consultants and technical assistants are used when they're needed.
Yeah.
What's the focus there?
You know, this is an area that can get really expensive. To do long-term evaluations, for example. And so consultants provide a service that allows organizations to improve upon this practice, especially if they can't do it themselves, right? Last year, Roe New York, during their site visit, spoke about their use of consultants and
now,
how...
Roe New York was one of the three finalists,
yes,
right, that I saw on the stage.
Yeah, right.
One of the three winners.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah. And they spoke during their site visit, which is the final stage of the selection process, about how they had used consultants to improve their own performance in this area to assess the impact of their work.
Do you remember what kinds of consultants they were using or in what areas?
Let's see. So in one area, they were working to improve their board's performance and making sure that they were setting expectations and that the responsibilities were clear. So, you know, this area about tracking results is not just about program results, but also about organizational results as well.
Yeah. Okay. The organization uses reflective learning. Mm-hmm. What is that?
It's an organization, you know, it's a practice that organizations are being mindful of what they're seeing and then reflecting back on that. So saying, well, why did that work a certain way or why didn't that work a certain way as we expected, perhaps? And then coming back and trying to take steps to sort of address whatever, you know, they did see, what the result was. You know, so they're not just resting in great results, for example, but they're trying to see how can they be even greater.
Yeah.
And okay. If something doesn't work, then how can we improve upon it going forward?
All right. How about we go to the governance structure, Michael?
How
governance structure that moves the organization forward.
How
okay?
about we do? Yes.
How about we do?
More high functioning. So in our experience, high performing nonprofits, and I say this without exception, all think of the relationship between their board of directors and their top manager, usually the executive director or the president, as a partnership. I say that because when I came into the sector 35 years ago, there was a tendency to see the board as the governance body, and they made the decisions and they made the policy. It never really worked like that, but it sounded nice on paper.
Okay.
But the truth is they've got to work together because both of them play essential roles in making sure that the organization is working at its optimum. And there are a lot of details to that, as you know, but the point is... you know, it's just to make sure that everybody's on the same page and we're all moving in the same direction and that we have some markers for determining whether we're getting there.
One of the standards is that the individual board members and the board overall is regularly evaluated.
Key. Huge thing. People think, well, the board should be evaluating the executive director every year. It's true.
That's true.
But
right.
a governance committee or some other body should be evaluating the performance of the board as a whole and the performance of every board member.
Mm.
Because it really is a job, and you want to make sure that everybody's playing on the team. Think about rowing a boat like Row New York does every day. And you get imagine if 11 people are rowing really well and one person's decided that this is lunchtime. You're not going to have a high-performing rowing team.
Yeah.
Teamwork is what nonprofits take to work effectively.
New board candidates get a recruitment prospectus and site visits.
Mm-hmm. It's a big deal.
What should be in that recruitment prospectus? What are we looking
well,
for?
Well, a lot of things. There's expectations. Ideally, you'd have a job description for board members. You'd have some sort of description of the kinds of functions of the different committees on the board. How will you be evaluated a year from now so people know what they're working against, you know, what will this test cover, as they say in school.
Mm.
And, you know, we give people, in our organization, we give people the last six meetings minutes so they can sort of get a flavor for how the board talks about things. We have a charge to every one of our committees that says not only what its duties are, but sort of what its goals or contributions should be.
Now, I presume Nonprofit Coordinating Committee of New York is adhering to these 8 standards.
We try.
It's very aspirational. They're very aspirational, really. I mean,
they are.
It's a constant iterative process. I can see that.
Exactly. And the exciting thing to us is about 50% of the people that apply now have applied before. And that's exactly the way that we structured the program.
Wait, is 50% of the organizations... Are repeat.
People keep coming back.
They want to do more. They want to come back to the...
And our most positive feedback comes from people that don't win. They say, this is the best thing we ever... It was an enormous amount of work.
That's great.
It's the best thing we ever went through. It's better than strategic planning. You know, it's better than anything else we've tried.
Cool.
And we didn't win this year, but we want to go through again next year. We give... Part of the reason for that is Melkus gives everybody an hour to an hour and a half of detailed feedback in a conference call after the process.
After the committee, feedback. Mm-hmm. Hour to hour and a half? You spend that long?
Here's what the committee said about your communications. Here's what the committee said about your financial management. Here's some areas where you need to improve. That's what would cost most nonprofits a lot of money in paid consultants.
And how many organizations do you do that for?
It's offered to everyone that applies. So, for example, in 2014, we had 77 applicants. I've done feedback calls with 53 of them. So that's about 70% of them, I think.
Okay.
That's a big commitment on our part, you know, to invest that time. But as she said, it's really, from our perspective, a training and consulting and coaching program more than a competition. The competition is, it's like The Voice, you know, they see The Voice on television, you know, the big payoff in The Voice is not whether you win that particular cycle. It's that you get to be part of some, you know, master musical person's team, and you're going to learn a mountain from that. Well, we hope you learn a mountain from our whole application process.
All right. Excellent. Okay. Another one just under the governance structure, that expectations are understood by board members. I guess that's part of that probably reflects on the recruitment prospectus.
Yeah, it does, but it's also something that needs a constant refresh, because board members, I think a lot of them have sort of fallen into a dreamlike stance, a trance where they believe, you know, my job is to come and make sure that the staff's doing a good job and pat them on the back. Mm. Well, that is part of their job, but there are a lot of other parts to their job, and they need to do it, and sometimes they need coaching and coaxing and help and all sorts of stuff, all of which is part of the picture. But staff does a lot of the driving of that process, but board members have very definite responsibilities.
Just a quick one. Do you think that the recruitment prospectus, should that be something that's signed by the board member? I acknowledge that I've received a copy and I understand it. Is that important?
Some organizations do that. Some organizations have an annual commitment statement where every board member signs a commitment that this year I will help raise this amount of money. With individualized goals.
Yeah.
This year I will attend at least 75% of all the board meetings, committee meetings, and so on. It's not a light thing. You know, I had a governance committee chair at a previous organization who used to say, it's the reverse of the old Army slogan, which used to say, it's not a job, it's a journey. He said, this is not a journey, it's a job.
Yeah.
It really, today, running a nonprofit corporation has never been more demanding.
But it's also, you know, one of those things where it's really closely related to having board assessments and having a report card, of the entire board or individual board members, mm-hmm. because that's another way to check in on whether they know what is expected of them, and to remind them when they are not performing and to acknowledge them when they are, you know, performing.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the annual commitment document or something like that. And of course, the individual board members are all being reviewed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, cool. Melkus, let's stay with you for accountable financial management. Why don't you point out what you think is important there?
Yeah, I think in this area, and Michael said one of the buzzwords earlier, sustainability, right? So the selection committee is really looking for organizations that are financially healthy and that are making smart choices in their finances so that they're around 5 years from now, 10 years from now, long term, right? The other thing that they're looking for here is how their mission is informing their financial practices. And sometimes we tend to think that those two things are separate, but are the finances informed by what is important to the organization, right? So for example, with Leek and Watts, who was our gold prize winner last year, they were really focused on making sure that their programs were being maximized, because beds that weren't full meant dollars that were being thrown
away. Why don't you tell us what Leek and Watts does?
Yeah, sure. So Leek and Watts has a school up in Yonkers. They also provide tons of programs and services for juvenile justice youth or kids that are involved
in the juvenile justice system.
And students with disabilities, they have programming for them as well. So it's a pretty multi-service organization. Yeah.
All right. So we want to see that alignment between financial priorities and mission, and that correct mission statement.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. Adequate cash reserves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to protect the organization against contingencies. Say something about that.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of ties back to what Michael was talking about earlier about having a diverse revenue stream. It's all about making sure that you're protecting yourself, and having that cash available is critically important. The selection committee looks for a minimum of 3 months of cash reserves, but ideally at least 6 months.
Okay. And of course, you keep saying the selection committee, mm-hmm. but we know that this is for all nonprofits, whether you enter the competition or not.
This has been an area of serious advancement in the nonprofit world of management and governance in the last 25, 30 years. There was a time when people thought, well, they should operate at a break even. You know, they should just barely make it every month because we don't want to pile up money in the closet. And the truth is, you do that and you're putting your entire mission at risk. It's a very silly way to do business.
In fact, there's a standard here for striving toward a budget surplus each year.
Yes, you should. One of the simplest ways, and people don't think about it, is one of the simplest ways to build a surplus is to put it in the budget every year. Contribution to the surplus, $50,000. Contribution to the surplus, $100,000. And treat it as an annual recurring expense. And next thing you know, you look up in 5 years.
So it's not just an afterthought.
Right, exactly. Yeah, well, it's not just what's left
let's
over.
See what's left at the end.
Because
yeah,
nonprofit yeah, people tend to always think of more needs and more things they can do and more activities.
Yeah.
But you got to think about preserving your organization.
Not unlike your own personal finances. We're supposed to budget for savings.
Yes.
Not just save what's left at the end
exactly.
of the month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
All right. All right. Let's stay with you, Michael, for diversity and culturally competent practices.
Well, this is a very rich area. The truth is, diversity, I think most people understand what that means, but diversity mm-hmm. is important, we believe, for all kinds of companies, not just nonprofit companies. But in the nonprofit sector, where we're frequently dealing with such diverse communities, it's especially critical that we have boards that represent that, staffs that represent that. And those are some of the questions that we and the practices that we focus on.
Yeah, representing the communities that they're serving.
The populations. But there's another issue in here, which is cultural competency, which is a little newer, but I think in many ways is more on point. And that is, if you're working with populations that are each have their own cultural and language and other kinds of barriers to perhaps to dealing with you, you know, it's part of your job to make sure that you can communicate with them in ways that are understood and that you understand enough about the culture and the language to make sure that not only are you getting the word out, but also you're getting communications back.
Yes, there's, and I think we're going to, you have it in one of the standards, regular feedback from the communities that you're serving.
Yeah, there's a great example. There's a wonderful organization, Bronx Works, that about 5 years ago applied. And when asked about diversity, said, they're in the Bronx. And they said, well, you know, we have several people on staff that speak Spanish. And I think at the time they thought that was a good answer. But the selection committee actually dinged them on that because the Bronx today represents a very diverse number of ethnic communities. And it goes way beyond the sort of historic image of the Puerto Rican South Bronx. So we came back this past year and asked them that same question. And they explained that they had the capacity now to simultaneously translate in 34 languages, that they had people on staff speaking 9 of the most frequently spoken languages in the Bronx, and they won.
Outstanding. What a great story. That's terrific. We just have about a minute left before we take a little break. The organization regularly assesses and responds to emerging needs. So that's a big part of that feedback. You got to know what your community's needs are.
Yeah, because the truth is...
Not be a static
especially
provider.
In New York City, no place like New York City where neighborhoods turn over constantly in terms of ethnic and demographic and other composition. Just look at Brooklyn or Queens in the last 10 or 15 years. So what you want to do is keep making sure that the geographic area you're serving or the issues that you're working on connect with those realities.
Outstanding. Mm-hmm. All right. We've got Tony's Take 2 and a lot more of the 8 areas of nonprofit excellence coming up. First, Generosity Series. They help you raise money by hosting multi-charity 5K runs and walks. Multi-charity because you're all small and mid-sized shops and you don't generate enough runners to do this on your own. But when the community comes together and there's a dozen or 15 nonprofits, then you can have a great event. And I know because I host them. I MC them. Sorry, Generosity Series hosts them. But I do the MCing for them. And I've seen the organizations, and they're raising like $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 in the day. And Generosity Series provides all the back-end support that you need and the dashboards, and they have that charity support team that helps you all with the fundraising so that you're raising your bottom line. Events are coming up in Brooklyn, New York, and Northern New Jersey, and Miami, Florida. Talk to Dave Lynn. He's the COO. You've heard me recommend it. Tell them you're from Nonprofit Radio. They're at 718-506-9777, or they're on the web, of course. Who isn't? It's got to be. GenerositySeries.com. But I like picking up the phone to talk to people. I was at the Nonprofit Technology Conference hosted by N10, the Nonprofit Technology Network, this week. In fact, it almost kept me from doing the show live because of the bad snow we had. I almost didn't get back in time, but obviously it wasn't a problem. I got 25 interviews. Very smart people, all for Nonprofit Radio. They'll be coming up. I was really moved by the response of the speakers to be interviewed. It was terrific. Some of the subjects: community building, video strategy, a broader content strategy, keeping your website current after a redesign. You know, it's not just static. You put it up and then you never revisit it. Keeping that current, moving your files to the cloud. Emerging social media, technology to reach rural and marginalized communities, the science of email deliverability, multi-channel storytelling, the future of technology, and what to do now to prepare for the future. And that's less than half of the interviews I got over these 25. Lots of really smart people sat down with me. The audio and video, we shot video there too, will be coming up in the coming months on Nonprofit Radio. All the info is at tonymartinetti.com. And that is Tony's Take Two for Friday, 6th of March, 9th show of 2015. Melkus, I think it's your turn, right? Okay. Does that sound all right?
Yep.
For the enlightened use of human resources. What's enlightened use?
So enlightened use means that that organizations are sort of maximizing the talent that is available of them, that they are taking care of their staff, what else? That they're sort of using their staff's experience to benefit the organization.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And another area in there is making sure that your risk level for your staff and for your organization is as low as possible, so that you don't allow your organization to be blown off course because of something you didn't expect. And for that matter, you don't subject your staff to such stressful conditions that it's bad for them. So it's really the care and nurturing of your staff as well as optimizing what they do.
One of the standards is professional development opportunities, internal and external, Melkus. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's something that the selection committee members really look for in strong organizations, is that they're investing in their staff, right? And so that can be, that can take the shape of online universities almost that are created for larger organizations and their staff, or something as simple as belonging to NPCC and sending your staff to the workshops that we put on. That's something else that a lot of organizations tout in their own applications.
All right. That there is a whistleblower and conflict of interest policies. Now, I notice those specific policies appear in two different standards. Why are those specifically mentioned, whistleblower and conflict of interest?
Well, one big thing is Sorry.
No, go ahead. No,
we just Michael. Finished passing the first revision of the New York State Not-for-Profit Corporation Law in 45 years. And I served on the Attorney General's task force that created much of the draft for that. And the truth is...
Oh, so I'm only two levels... I'm only 2 degrees of separation from New York State Attorney General?
2 degrees of separation,
wow.
Exactly, from Mr. Schneider.
I wish I had known you all this long.
But the upshot is it requires now, it used to be recommended, it now requires that every nonprofit have a conflict of interest policy and a whistleblower policy. And not everyone for whistleblower, you have to be above a certain budget level. But the point is that there's much more law undergirding those two policies.
What conflicts of interest are we talking about? Is this between the board and the organization?
Primarily material conflicts of interest. Your sister is the treasurer, right? Or the money, we're paying an insurance company. This is an actual example. We're paying an insurance company to insure all of our operations. But it turns out you're paying the insurance company more than they really charge, and they're taking the extra and kicking it back to you as executive director. It's just a couple of examples of flagrant abuse.
That's about it.
Somebody just went to prison last year for 11 years of that kind of behavior. And the truth is, it turns out this is far more important even than the audit. We actually raised the threshold for audits in the state from $250,000 up to $1 million over the next 5 years.
Yeah, give a break to the smaller organizations.
Exactly.
Because an audit,
every one of the organizations that you've read headlines about people stealing money in the last 15 years, they had a clean audit the year before. So the point I'm making is, it's not that the auditors weren't doing their job. They were. An audit is a very limited tool to assess the finances.
And, okay. And the conflict of interest part, are we also thinking about... conflicts between board members doing business with the organization?
Yep. Yeah, that's part of what's covered.
Okay.
There's a whole list of things. If your mother, brother, sister, grandfather, any people like that, any relatives, children, life partners or people are also being paid by the organization, then you have to do a declaration. You have to fill out a form every year.
Succession planning is a part of this too. That's part of risk minimization.
It is. You don't want an organization that is suddenly hit from sideways because the executive director dies, gets run over by a truck is the favorite example, or just gracefully retires, whatever it is. You want to know about that. You want to plan for it in advance. You want to have a process established for how it's going to work. In big organizations, you might even have somebody in waiting. in smaller organizations, you at least know what the plan is.
Yeah. And it could even be, you mentioned, it could be retirement. Retirement could be or resignation could be sudden.
Yeah.
And ideally, the person would stay until the replacement is in place, but maybe their next job doesn't allow that.
Exactly.
And then that could shake things up pretty seriously when the CEO walks in and says, you know, I'm only going to be here another 3 months.
Yep. Big deal.
Okay. Now I'm going back to Melkus because you took over. All right. Melkus, information technology. This is big. Reliable. We have reliable. So if we're using Windows XP still, that's we probably do not have, which is totally unsupported and has been unsupported by Microsoft for, I think, a year now or something. Mm-hmm. That's not a reliable IT system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So this area actually focuses more on like IT infrastructure as a whole, right?
Yeah.
But also,
yeah, I'm shallow. I mean, yeah. I take shallow examples.
So here we're looking at, you know, making sure that you have the technology that you need to make sure that the organization is efficient, that it's, you know, sort of making everyone's job a little bit easier. But also, you know, what roles does technology play in advancing your mission-related goals as well? So we often hear about how organizations are trying to use technology to sort of help deliver the programs and services that they offer. Mm-hmm. So I guess this area is twofold. It's about building that infrastructure to support your staff, but also the infrastructure to support your programs as well.
Yeah, okay. I see that disaster preparedness and disaster recovery planning is a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interviews I did, we're gonna have a half a show devoted to that because it's one of the NTC interviews I got was exactly that. Why so important?
Well, we saw it with Sandy firsthand, right? Organizations that didn't have that solid infrastructure were unable to return to work and basically were not able to provide services and programming. Organizations that had a more solid infrastructure were able to, even though they might not have been able to return to their offices physically, were able to continue their work with pretty minimal interruptions because they were able to work remotely from home. And we saw that, you know, with our own organization, where a lot of us were able to work from home, even though it was difficult to commute into the office.
Yeah. Okay. And even if you can't maintain full operations, mm-hmm. at least you can, you're functioning, you're in communications with each
right.
other. You can communicate outward to the people that you're serving. I mean, at a minimum, you know, I think those things are important, just
right.
the communications. What was your, Michael, what was the your CEO there, president there? What was the post-Sandy like for a nonprofit coordinating committee?
Well, it was quite hectic because a lot of organizations were, you know, trying to scramble to come up with solutions to problems that varied all over the map, from literally being underwater to having some of their systems knocked out to having clients that were stranded in communities that were heavily impacted by the hurricane.
Mm.
And one of our winners, actually, in the Excellence Awards program, Red Hook Initiative, had the foresight 4 years earlier to build a wireless network in the largest public housing project in Brooklyn. And it was done for the right programmatic reasons, the very reasons Melkus just mentioned, so that they could communicate easily and cheaply out to the people that live there. This is a low-income population. So that those people could talk directly back to Red Hook Initiative and say, we need a program that does this and we need some economic work on this and so on. It's a very rambunctious program, does a lot of stuff.
Mm.
And they didn't plan it, I don't think, as a disaster response mechanism, but when the flood hit and they had, I think, 14,000 people stranded in all these buildings with no elevators and very difficult problems with medications and food and stuff, they were able, nonetheless, in most cases, to communicate at least with every floor, and they were able to talk to people, go in and get people out, bring stuff in. So, you know, you forget sometimes, you think of IT and wireless services, you know, as stuff that you have to have a certain level of affluence for. But, you know, when you use public broadband and things like that, you can actually make it quite cheap. Mm. So nonprofits are finding very innovative ways to use IT, I think,
okay.
to augment their mission.
All right. And it's part of the standards.
Yep.
Melkus, there should be a technology plan. It shouldn't just all be happening haphazardly. We actually should be planning our use of tech.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I feel like a lot of organizations don't do, but it's a worthwhile investment. It helps you sort of monitor the systems that you have in place and thinking about where you're going in the future and what sort of investments in your IT you're going to need to make, yeah. right? And that also sort of gets the different parts of the organization involved in talking about IT as it relates to them as well. So, you know, IT should not just be the job or responsibility of one person, but really it should be integrated into the entire, you know, organization and its functioning.
Yeah, including the people who are doing the programming work.
Exactly. I mean,
everybody's feeding in at least to the person who has the responsibility.
Right.
There was something that, confidentiality standards, privacy standards. Let's say a little about the importance of thinking about this.
Yeah, and this becomes a bigger issue with the following area as well, of communications. But, you know, there are organizations that do health-related work that need to really be mindful of the HIPAA standards and the responsibilities that they owe to their clients to make sure that their information is protected and kept confidential.
Okay. Michael, anything you want to add on the on the IT side?
Nope. Just obviously with all social media that are exploding and with all the various ways in which people network these days, nonprofits have to be at least keeping up with that and making sure that they've got the ability to reach people in at least a lot of those ways.
And this would flow back to the financial management. I think there should be budgeting for IT to support the IT plan that we need to have in this area.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It is a growing budget item in a lot of nonprofits' lives.
Sure.
And it cuts across communications and just the basic infrastructure of technology, but it's pretty much an indispensable assumption today that you need that.
Mm-hmm. We can take a little do a little live listener love. We got more New York joined us. Welcome additional New York City people, and Madison, Wisconsin joined us. Live listener love going out there to Madison. Let's go abroad. We've got in China, we've got Wenzhou and Taizhou, China. Ni hao. Seoul, Korea, and Yangsan, Korea. Love one, South Korea. So loyal. Always South Korean listeners. Please. Anyo hasayo. And going to Japan, konnichiwa to Honda and Misato. Konnichiwa. We got Hungary with us. We can't see your city, Hungary, but we know that you're with us. Live listener love going out to Hungary and bringing it back here to the States. Middletown, Delaware joined us. Live listener love. Of course, those podcast pleasantries always, and the affiliate affections. So important. Okay. We're moving on. You can hear me turning pages. Where are we now? With Michael, right? Michael tends to take over a bit, but... Really, Sam? Oh, we got a minute for a break. Okay. Oh, it's Melkus's turn? Okay, Melkus. We're going to, I'll tell you what, let's go out for a break now. I think it makes sense to have our break now. When we come back, effective communications that Melkus was just alluding to. Stay with us.
Like what you're hearing on Nonprofit Radio? Tony's got more. On YouTube, you'll find clips from his stand-up comedy, TV spots, and exclusive interviews. Catch guests like Seth Godin, Craig Newmark, the founder of Craigslist, Mark Echo of Echo Enterprises, Charles Best from DonorsChoose.org, Aria Finger of DoSomething.org, and Naomi Levine from New York University's Hyman Center on Philanthropy. Tony tweets, too. He finds the best content from the most knowledgeable and interesting people in and around nonprofits to share on his stream. If you have valuable info, he wants to retweet you. During the show, you can join the conversation on Twitter using hashtag NonprofitRadio. Twitter is an easy way to reach Tony. He's at Tony Martinetti, MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. He hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a short, monthly show devoted to getting you over your fundraising hurdles. Just like Nonprofit Radio, Tony talks to leading thinkers, experts, and cool people with great ideas. As one fan said, "Tony picks their brains and I don't have to leave my office." Fundraising Fundamentals was recently dubbed the most helpful nonprofit podcast you have ever heard. You can also join the conversation on Facebook, where you can ask questions before or after the show. The guests are there, too. Get insider show alerts by email. Tony tells you who's on each week and always includes links so that you can contact guests directly. To sign up, visit the Facebook page or TonyMartinetti.com.
I'm Rob Mitchell, CEO of Atlas of Giving, and you're listening to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%.
Welcome back to Big Nonprofit Ideas for the Other 95%. And since we did the Live Listener Love, Wigan, UK joined us. Welcome, Wigan. Live Listener Love out to you. Melkus, you're up. Communications and use of communications technology. Why is this important?
Yeah, so with this area, we're really focused on not just how organizations are broadcasting their own work and the services that they provide, but also, you know, going back to that piece of feedback, how are they asking their different stakeholders, not just their clients, but their funders, their other donors, their board members, even volunteers, how are they asking them for feedback? And then what are organizations doing with that feedback?
Oh, so our communication's out, and then we're also listening in.
Right.
We need to be listening to our stakeholders.
Right. So there's that focus on the two-way communications. And with the stakeholders, it's not just about communicating with all of them in the exact same way. There should be the communications practices should really be tailored towards the stakeholders. And you would know, you know, what works with them by sort of tracking the effectiveness of your communication strategies and also just by listening to them. Right. So what is it that they like to hear about? How do they like to be communicated with?
Yes,
right?
Critical. I mean, yeah. you got to go to where people are. Not the channel that you want them to be on.
Exactly.
Whether it's email or social media or your site or a blog or live events, you got to go where they are.
Right. And with social media, it's not even just about, you know, being on everything that's available.
Right.
It's about being really mindful about how you use each forum. So, for example, the Washington Heights Corner Project was a finalist last year, and they talked about how they use social media for the purposes of connecting with city officials. Right. So if they attend events and didn't get to shake a hand, they will tweet at the city official and say, sorry, I missed you. Hope we can reconnect at some point.
Yeah.
Right. So that's a very smart use and very targeted use of one particular media.
And your point about not being in all of them just because they exist. When I was at, again, Nonprofit Technology Conference this week, a few people mentioned, you know, avoiding shiny object syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Just because there's something new and shiny, a new network, a new social channel, doesn't mean that you need to be on it.
Right.
Are your people there? Do they want to hear from you there?
Mm-hmm.
Does it make sense for the age, the geography, the other demographics of the people you're talking to?
Right. Yeah, cool. It might not make sense for your audience.
Yeah. I noticed that there's something mentioned about formal and informal communication strategies. I mean, this could be just meeting people in the building where they live.
Right. Or even, you know, mapping out sort of a touch strategy, right, for particular people. For donors, maybe, where you're going to map out how many times a year you're going to speak to them, and whether, you know, you want to make sure that, especially with funders, this is true. You want to make sure that each touch is not an ask, right? So one of them might be, you know, how's your daughter doing? Is she liking college? Right? Something very simple like that. That's an informal check-in, but something that can go a long way, right? And says also a lot about how you communicate with your different audiences.
Making the Form 990 available is mentioned in this standard, this area, and in a couple of others too. One or two others. What are you looking for? That 990.
It speaks to transparency of the organization. Is the organization willing to put its finances out there for the public to review? And I think, Michael, you can jump in here, but I'm seeing that more and more of them are available online because it's a testament to how the organization sort of holds itself accountable by putting out there its finances for others to see.
Yeah. Michael, anything you want to
add? Yeah, we actually did a national guide to how to read the 990 and figure out what it means because it's a complicated form. The IRS requires it. It's not just a financial form. It asks you to talk about, are you still pursuing the mission that you were created for?
Mm.
Are you getting results? What does your board look like? It's a pretty exhaustive look at your organization from different angles. And they are all indeed online, but the truth is, you know, not every organization puts it on its own website.
Yeah, I was going my question was going to be where
they're accessible at the national level from an organization called GuideStar.
GuideStar, of course.
Yeah.
Is that for the committee? Now I am going to focus on what the committee is looking for. Is that sufficient if it's available on GuideStar?
They want to see your 990 on. Certainly, they want to see it referenced on GuideStar, maybe a link, or
from
something.
Your site.
Yes,
to it on GuideStar.
It's different than a financial form because it gives the organization a chance to talk about its mission, its progress, its ways of tracking progress, and that sort of stuff. So, you know, nonprofits have, as Jim Collins once said, really have two bottom lines. We have a financial bottom line, and we have what they call a return on social investment. And that's the way in which you are or are not fulfilling your mission. Are you changing anything in the world? Mm. And you should be able to track both of those things every year. Ideally, your 990, and there's certain sections of it that will help people figure that out. Are they making progress? Are they helping more kids? Are they getting the kids not only into high school but into college? Are they, you know, that sort of stuff?
I had a guest a couple of months ago now, CPA, Yiit Uchtoom, and the conversation was about using the 990 as a marketing tool.
Yeah.
Where these narrative sections, instead of just copying and pasting from your mission statement, you know, you use the narrative to be more effusive about what your work is, because it is so widely available. Use it as a marketing tool.
Right.
All right. All right. We just have a couple minutes left, and I want to talk some more about these the workshops that are that you conduct. Are they strictly in-person events, or are they on the web that others can take advantage of, Melkus?
The Pathways to Excellence workshops are in-person events, but what we do is we post the materials that are distributed at each of the sessions on our awards website. So folks can still have access to all of the tools and templates that we share in person.
Okay, cool. And it's called Pathways to Excellence?
Pathways to Excellence.
And, of course, the organization site is npccny.org. And where would people go to find the resources you're talking about, Melkus?
Yeah, so actually they would be on the awards microsite, which is npexcellence.fcny.org, and there's a section for that on Pathways to Excellence.
Okay, say that URL one more time, a little slower for the awards microsite.
Yep, it's npexcellence.fcny.org.
Okay, excellent.
And there's a link to that on our website.
Right? Yes.
There's a link to it at nppccny.org.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you're raising the level of lots and lots of nonprofits. I mean, it's important for people to recognize this is not just a competition.
Right.
All right. And those have started, the workshops have started, you said March to November, so they've started, right?
Yeah, so we've conducted three of them to date. So the one on fundraising, one on results, and one on human resources.
Okay.
We have two more coming up.
And for those folks who are in New York, what's the date of the ceremony? I very much hope to be there. We might be talking about that, Michael.
Yep, so for the 2015 awards, the date is November 19th.
Okay.
Location to be determined.
Okay, excellent. That's Michael Clark, he's president of the Nonprofit Coordinating Committee of New York, and Melkus Alvarez-Baez, director of programs, also at NPCC, and they are at NPCCNY on Twitter. Michael, Melkus, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Tony. This has been a great conversation.
I appreciate it. Thank you. My pleasure. Next week, bring joy to your donors. Major gift, relationship building. If you missed any part of today's show, you know where to find it. TonyMartinetti.com. You knew that. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Sam Leibowitz is on the board as the line producer. Where's our music, Sam? The show's social media is by Susan Chavez. There it is. Thank you, Sam. She's at SusanChavez.com. And our music is by Scott Stein of Brooklyn. It's Cheap Red Wine is the song. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.
What's not to love about Nonprofit Radio? Tony gets the best guests. Check this out from Seth Godin.
This is the first revolution since TV 1950 and Henry Ford 1920. It's the revolution of our lifetime.
Here's a smart, simple idea from Craigslist founder Craig Newmark.
Yeah, in sites or in presentation or anything, people don't really need the fancy stuff. They need something which is simple and fast.
When's the best time to post on Facebook? Facebook's Andrew Noyes knows.
At traffic is at an all-time high around 9 a.m. or 8 p.m. So that's when you should be posting your most meaningful posts.
Here's Aria Finger, COO of DoSomething.org.
Young people are not going to be involved in social change if it's boring and they don't see the impact of what they're doing. So you got to make it fun and applicable to these young people, because otherwise a 15 and 16-year-old, they have better things to do. They have Xbox, they have TV, they have their cell phones.
Ami Dar is the founder of Idealist.
It took 2 or 3 years for foundation staff to sort of deign to add an email address to their card. It was phone. This email thing is right. Weird. And plus, why should I give it away?
Charles Best founded DonorsChoose.org.
Somehow they've gotten in touch, kind of offline, as it were.
Yeah.
And they'll do exchanges of brownies and visits and physical gift.
Mark Echo is the founder and CEO of Echo Enterprises. You may be wearing his hoodies and shirts. Tony talked to him.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big believer that it's not what you make in life. It's you know, it's how you make people feel.
This is public radio host Majora Carter.
Innovation is in the power of understanding that you don't just, you know, you just put money on a situation and expect it to heal. You put money on a situation and invest it and expect it to grow.
And savvy advice for success from Eric Saperstein.
What separates those who achieve from those who do not is in direct proportion to one's ability to ask others for help.
The smartest experts and leading thinkers are on Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%.